If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Today on Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel.
Tens of trillions of dollars are being extracted from the United States of America. Democrats aren't doing it. Republicans are not doing it. An entire integrated system, financial system, trading system, taxing system that was created by both parties over a period of two decades.
You can see you went on this rant and it became a thing that went viral.
That clip from 2011, it's 2025. It's going to be 2026. 15 years ago. That's how you know the system is so messed up. We went to the owners of the NASDAQ in Times Square. They were like, we'll give you your own studio in Times Square. That became one of the most successful television shows in the history of financial television. I began the process of my political activism against the coordinated corruption of the two political parties working together.
I want to get to September 11th because that's a big day that we both were together.
Two dozen of my good friends were in that building working. A number of your good friends were in that building working, but more significantly, your fiance was in that building working. I think it changed both of our lives permanently.
You live in Italy.
Yes, I live in Italy, but I also live specifically in Milan. I wanted to do a new Italian sneaker company in Milan. The goal is to provide the world with the most comfortable and stylish Italian sneaker ever.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. There are moments in television that cut through the noise, moments so raw, so unfiltered that they become cultural touchstones. For Dylan Radigan, that moment came live on MSNBC in 2011 when his frustration with America's broken financial system boiled over into a viral rant that said out loud what millions of people were feeling but couldn't put into words. It was the kind of television you can't script. Anger, truth, vulnerability, all colliding in a way that made people stop and listen. And to this day, that rant still holds the same amount of weight. But now Dylan is an entrepreneur, creating companies like Euphoria Sneakers and taking over reservations.com. He's taking the same passion that once electrified television and pouring it into businesses that focus on sustainability, travel, and building things that last. But underneath it all, Dylan is still a truth teller. Still the guy unafraid to say the system is broken. Still searching for ways to make it better. In our conversation, Dylan opens up about why he really left the media, what people misunderstand about him, and how he now defines success. Spoiler, it's not about ratings or headlines, it's about impact. Dylan and I also share some stories with you on how we met each other and how we got so close. So today's conversation is one about reinvention, of refusing to be boxed into a single role, of proving that sometimes the loudest way to make change is to step away from the microphone and get to work. Please enjoy my conversation with my friend, Dylan Radigan. Dylan Ratigan, thank you so much for joining me on my show, Misunderstood.
It is an absolute honor and a pleasure. Very nice to see you.
Oh, so people don't know this, and I'm so excited for them to know this, but we worked together many years ago. What is it now, like 20 or something?
We didn't discuss time.
Yeah, 25.
But it was in the past.
Yeah, in the past. For a couple years, and always on the other side of this. You were on TV, I was the...
You were the producer,
I was
the
lowly person on the assignment desk first. Then I think I rose the ranks a little bit and became...
Rose quickly and inappropriately.
Yeah, but we had some amazing times.
We did.
You taught me a lot. And before we get into all of that, I just want to know, how did you get there? Because I arrived there and you were like the most intimidating senior person on air, this presence that when you walked in the room, it was like you ran Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. You were the guy. Mm-hmm. So I don't even know how you got there. What made you get into media and what had you done up until that point?
I mean, it was a job. It was my first job out of, just like you.
Yeah.
Bloomberg was your first job out of school.
How long had you been there?
I started when I was 22. I mean,
I've
been there for 5 or 6 years.
Okay. And did you start on air?
No. I started as on the rewrite desk as a reporter in New Jersey, rewriting press releases. It was my first job out of college.
Wow.
But it was also just the combination of like fortunate timing, because I was one of the first reporters hired by Bloomberg.
Right.
Bloomberg was at a moment when I started at that company, there were 8,000 Bloomberg terminals in the world. Now there's, you know, 300,000 or 400,000. I don't even know how many.
Right.
And so I just happened to also come in at a moment when that company was on the verge of explosive growth. And when you're inside of a company that's growing extremely fast, there's unlimited opportunity, because there's much more work to be done than there are people to do the work. And so much of life is really a function of timing. And if you end up in the right company at the right time and you can do the things that need to get done, you can get a lot of opportunity.
Right, if your work ethic is
And if you have whatever the skills are. I mean, for me, even when I was a little boy, the most interesting thing for me was always to go to wherever the most action was.
Yeah.
You know, and so I like activity. I like when things are happening. I like to go when I was, you know, 3 years old, I'd run into the hurricane. And my mother would be like, why are you outside in a hurricane? You
know? Right.
And I'd say, because look at this hurricane. It's amazing. And so it was partially accidental, partially intentional. I wanted to be, I had an interest in being a reporter. I had an interest in being in New York City. And Bloomberg was hiring, and so I was able to get a job first in New Jersey rewriting press releases, and then one thing led to another, and I became the television host that you were describing.
So you didn't have necessarily any skills in TV or business news at the time?
No, I was 22 years old. I graduated from Union College, and I was trained by Bloomberg,
right,
on how to do all those things. So at that point, Bloomberg was a small company,
mm-hmm,
medium-sized company, small enough that every 3 months, everybody who had been new hires were put into a 3-week training program,
right,
that was run by Michael Bloomberg himself.
Right.
And so I was among the last training class that was actually run by Michael Bloomberg, not by the training organization, although there are lots of other people that were involved with the training. And sort of the pleasure of that.
So time. You got to understand the system, the Bloomberg.
Well, and just the attention.
Yeah.
I mean, because Bloomberg's strategy, the company and the person, was hire smart young people, invest huge amounts of resources in training
people.
Them. Mm-hmm. And those who perform, reward them constantly. And those who don't perform, get rid of them immediately. I mean, Bloomberg, as you know, most corporations, especially that corporation, at that time, most corporations function on more of a passive-aggressive culture.
Right.
Bloomberg functioned on an aggressive-aggressive culture.
Right.
And so if you performed, there was immediate rewards and advancement, and if you didn't perform, there was immediate elimination. It was like a very specific culture.
And your skill is you asked a lot of questions, and that's probably what made you stand out and rise in the ranks there, because that seemed to be how you got to where you were.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I also just think, because of my curiosity, going back to my interest as a little boy and mm-hmm, everything, where I've been in 80 countries, I've lived in Japan, I live in Italy now. I like to have new experiences. I want new and complex challenges,
yeah,
some small. But I would say that the key characteristic for me, I think, that helped me with that and still helps me today is listening comprehension,
mm-hmm,
I listen to people, and I want to understand them, and reading comprehension. So to just the ability to like, the more I can understand what's important for you. So if you're interviewing the Treasury Secretary, you're interviewing the U.S. President, or if you're interviewing the CEO of a company, the interview is much better if you're able to understand the priorities for that person. And it sort of has also just helped me in general.
But you were also very good at balancing that and conversations like that with understanding that you may have some viewers that didn't understand that person's job at all.
Right.
So you were great at getting them to...
As a translator.
To translate and to talk to even that woman folding her laundry at home during the day, listening and wanting to smarten up a little, but in a way that she could understand and it was interesting.
I spent a lot of my childhood explaining things to my mother.
Okay.
And so I'm very, in addition to sort of listening and reading comprehension, I also have a reasonably good ability to translate complex ideas into relatively simple concepts.
Yeah.
That has also helped me for sure.
So, you know, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the culture at Bloomberg was a lot different, like you were saying, than in other companies. And I loved it. I don't know your experience. I love that no one really, everyone had a title, but you were able to move.
It was a flat organization. Mike didn't have an office.
Right. And there was
there
was no walls. Everything was glass. You could see what everyone was doing. And I really thought that made a difference because you could be whoever you wanted to be. You could get whatever job and attain that role if you just tried hard, if you asked questions, if you got yourself
involved. You could
walk
right up to Mike Bloomberg's desk and be like, I think we should start a television show.
Right.
And he'd be like, tell me why.
Right. And having that access was what made the difference, I think.
Yeah.
Because everyone's opinion or questions mattered. And you don't really see that anywhere.
Well, it really spoiled me for life, honestly. One of the biggest reasons why I think I've spent the last 10 years creating my own companies or participating with other entrepreneurs like my friend Tim Henschel, who we'll talk about from Hotel Planner, where they created these things from nothing, is because I really miss that culture. I mean, I spent, as you know, a lot of my career working at NBC, which was much more visible, much more sort of a high profile. But the culture at NBC is closed doors, offices, all that passive aggressive, all the backstabbing, all the sort of triangulation.
Right.
And because Bloomberg was such a direct organization, direct engagement and flat, it was fabulous in my opinion. And I think you and I both appreciated that.
Yeah, 100%. And so I would credit you to being one of the people that really taught me about work ethic and about asking questions and about killing people with kindness. And if you don't know the answer, don't be ashamed of that, but just go figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I really learned that from you. You were someone who, if I didn't have the answer, you would come, you would spend time with me at my desk, you would show me how to do it. I would get frustrated and be like, well, here's where it ends. I can't go further than this. And you'd be like, what are you talking about? Of course you can. You need to ask this person. You need to go here. And I don't see that work ethic in the younger generations at all. Like, people stop me all the time and say, you're much quicker. You get it quicker. You do things in a way that I don't see in younger people. And as I was saying before we started this, it's really hard to hire younger people because I think the work ethic is so different. Do you see that?
I mean, yes and no. I think that there's always a sense that I think every generation forever has always said, well, the kids these days are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think there's an aspect of that. But I also think that If you have a clear purpose and a clear mission, you will naturally attract other people who want to be part of that.
Right.
And so I believe that the thing to do, I wouldn't be afraid of your inbox. Instead of looking for somebody to be a producer or an assistant or whatever for this show, you're better to look into the inbox of somebody who loves this show.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, you know, the reason Euphoria is Euphoria is because I was able to put out the signal that I wanted to do a new Italian sneaker company in Milan, which is a crazy idea for an American to do in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did that, there were younger Italians who became aware that I was trying to do that and who put themselves forward and said, we would like to help with that. You have to have the patience to put out the signal for who you are and what you're doing and then let the people that respond to that signal come to you rather than trying to grab people and mold them into what you're trying to do. So maybe the younger people are less and maybe they're not. But can I tell you one quick story that I remember just about our discussions?
That's good advice. Yeah, for sure.
I can remember sitting with you, this is early on, because the other thing that's a priority for me, not just in the context of any relationship with anyone, is not just to know the thing, like this is a shoe or this is a cup or this is a microphone, but why? Someone doesn't really learn if you just say, well, this is the list of things you need to do.
Right.
Someone learns if they have a context for why these things need to be done. Right. And I can remember saying to you I remember this very clearly. And I said to you, why does Wall Street exist? Like, why does it exist? Why do we have the New York Stock Exchange? Why are there stocks? Why are there regulations? Why are there regulators? And you said, so people can make money. And I remember laughing, and I was like, so you think that we've got just so people can make money, which obviously people make a tremendous amount of money. And right. It was actually a reasonable answer and probably a more true answer. But it just led to the conversation about the idea that, no, in the world, there's human beings and companies that have ideas, and those ideas need money to manifest. And then there's people who have money who want to participate in new ideas. And the reason Wall Street exists at its highest and best purpose is if a group of brilliant individuals have an idea for a cure for cancer, but they don't have the money, that they can go to Wall Street and explain why their idea is a great idea and then get money.
Right.
And so anyway, but once you understand that the reason Wall Street exists is to combine money with ideas, and that everything else is really just in support of that, it helps you understand all the little tasks. So anyway, right. I just would say that, send your signal and let the people come to you. And context is the easiest way to learn is if you have a context for why things exist.
Right. So I want to get to September 11th because that's a big day that we both were together. I rarely talk to people that I actually spent that actual day with. And it's interesting to me because in my opinion, and I'm curious about yours, that was a day that changed for you as an anchor as well, or someone on TV.
Yeah, it changed my life forever. I think it changed both of our lives permanently.
100%. But as someone who is on air, you're used to the teleprompter, you're used to also ad-libbing, but interviewing people and talking about business news.
Right, in a pretty narrow scope.
Right. All of a sudden, you're on air, and anyone who was on air during that morning essentially got caught on air until 11 or 12 1 o'clock for you, when they could finally get off air, they could cut to a commercial, and they had to ad lib, they had to figure it out. You were relying, I don't want to tell you what you were relying on, but
I was relying on you,
someone like me or people.
Well, you were the producer for this. I think we should not beat around the bush.
Okay.
I was the host of the morning show on Bloomberg at the time.
Yeah.
The first planes hit the buildings while I was on air. Mm-hmm. Because of that, they extended me, basically. They just had me stay. You were my producer.
Right.
You were in the control room, in the earpiece.
Right. Well, originally I was upstairs.
Whatever.
I was upstairs and—
You were in direct communication.
I was in direct communication.
I was receiving communication from you on the DM or whatever it is.
On the terminal,
But it's the Bloomberg DM.
Yes, right. And what I do remember is that everyone thought it was just a passenger plane or a small plane, and no one was in chaos. And I'm upstairs saying, I'm going to have to call analysts. I got to call airlines. I got to see how this is going to affect the open. So that's what I was worried about. And you're doing what you're doing, and then the second plane hits.
Also just as a point of context, because I think that one thing that is a bond that you and I share, and also is a differentiation between us and a lot of other people, is— – two dozen of my good friends were in that building working.
Yeah.
A number of your good friends were in that building working, but most significantly, your fiance was in that building working.
Right.
So we were in a social, it was not just a news event, it was a social experience, and we didn't know what was about to happen.
Right. We had no— I say this all the time, and it's a terrible word, but we did not have the creativity to realize the buildings were actually going to fall. This day was going to end the way it was going to end. And I will fast forward to a moment later that you and I go back and talk to, where we end up downstairs, just the two of us.
At 1 p.m.
At 1 p.m. after you get off air. We must have texted each other and said, we got to meet. And people are walking up silent Park Avenue.
No cars. And it's just people.
In soot. Covered in soot, people that are just crying, people are not talking.
But thousands of people.
And we are standing there on Park Avenue, lighting up a cigarette and almost laughing because we were like, what the hell is going on?
Well, also because we had gone into the building at 5 a.m. that morning, like we do every day.
Right.
We hadn't left the building for 9 hours.
Yeah.
We'd spent the night. And the thing is, when you're in a studio environment like we're in now, it's a surreal experience because there's a separation between yourself and reality because you're looking at cameras and there's microphones and people are made up and it's sort of very controlled.
Yeah.
So even though we're getting this information, even though we watch the buildings collapse together and we watch the communication with our friends and your family disappear as those buildings collapse, it still didn't, for me, the reality didn't set in until we were on Park Avenue smoking that cigarette. And now I'm not a television anchor. You're not a television producer.
Right.
We're two people who live in New York watching our fellow New Yorkers walk home covered in the disaster.
And wondering the big question that I remember saying to you, I will never forget. I wish it was a year from now so we knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, we did not know how that day was going to end. We didn't know that the not knowing might extend for a few days, for a month. You know, they didn't find Andy's body for months.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be getting into something that's too sensitive.
No, not at all.
The fact that we all went home that night and did not know who was going to come home.
Correct.
And there was no information.
Right.
And so the only way information was gathered is you woke up the morning of September 12th.
Yeah.
And on the morning of September 12th, there were certain people that didn't come home.
Right. Andy being one of them. And so I didn't go back into work for at least a couple months. And it was obviously, and we don't have to get into that, the most devastating thing that happened to me, but I shared that day with you. And it was something that I will always have with you.
Yeah.
And we will always have that bond. And
but we shouldn't smoke cigarettes.
We shouldn't. And I haven't. I mean, I did for a little while after, but I haven't.
Good.
Do you? You now live in Italy.
No.
Okay.
Although recently, yes, but sometimes no.
Well, I took Chantix.
Okay, I did as well.
It makes you see dead people. Did that happen to you?
No, but I do get crazy dreams, though.
Yeah. Well, I had crazy dreams awake. Like, after day four.
What do you mean, see dead people?
I don't know. I was like, I'm seeing dead people.
Dead people you know or just people?
No. I'll tell you. I was walking down the street. There was a homeless man. And I remember thinking, don't look in his eyes. He doesn't have eyes. He's the devil. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell are you talking about? And it was day four.
Of Chantix.
Of Chantix. I stopped it at day five, but it still worked. I never smoked again.
Chantix is a magical drug.
Magical.
It's unbelievable. It actually makes you not want to smoke.
Yeah.
I did use it as well.
And it makes you not want to drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The interesting thing with the Chantix is because it's so effective, I use it as an excuse to smoke. Because then I know if I ever want to not smoke, I can just take
Chantix. Oh, you can take Chantix. Yeah, yeah. Right.
Which is terrible, actually.
But
at the moment, I'm not smoking.
But you live in Italy. So, all right.
But even the Italians, listen, Italy gets a bad rap because Italy is the young. I live in Italy.
Okay.
But I also live specifically in Milan. Mm. And I also get the privilege of working with a really amazing group of young Italian professionals who I don't think are reflective of the cliche or the stereotype of Italians. Meaning that they are extremely hardworking. I think the Italians get a bad rap for not being hardworking. I think that I know that the people that I work with work as hard or harder than anybody that I worked with at Bloomberg or NBC.
Oh.
I think they're extremely creative. I think they're extremely passionate, and I think they're extremely healthy. You know, the idea that everybody's sort of smoking and hanging around drinking Aperol Spritz and always on holiday is sort of a pleasant joke, right? The Italians.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you, I live in Milan and I'm the only American working with an incredible group of young Italian men and women with the euphoria with the sneaker business. But it's not just that. I have other friends of mine that are young Italians with real estate businesses or with, you know, the pharmaceutical things, whatever. They work their ass off.
Yeah.
And they are incredibly talented. Now, maybe that's only Milan, but I think it's more that the world is driven by young people that want to create things. And Milan has become a magnet for that energy, not just for Italians, but for a lot of people around the world. So anyway, I just would like to speak a little bit of counter-narrative
on
behalf of the Italians.
I think that's great. I didn't.
And it's illegal to smoke it. By the way, the smoking rules, you can't, like, if you think you can go, you want to go with your fiance, I know you were recently engaged, you want to go and sit out and have an Aperol Spritz and take a look at the Castello Sforzesca and enjoy yourself, have a cigarette, illegal.
Can't do it.
Illegal.
Okay.
It's not as bad as LA, where you can't smoke on the sidewalk anywhere.
Right.
But it is illegal.
Can you spit gum on the ground? Like, I don't think you're allowed to do here.
I don't do that, okay. And so I can't say.
So you've never been stopped
never tested
for that.
It.
Right. Okay. Well, probably.
But
don't.
I would hope that you can't.
Yeah, I would hope so too.
Like spitting gum, it seems to be a why.
Seems like a terrible
idea.
Don't
do that. I think chewing gum in general is questionable.
Yeah. Well, I agree.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people do that
anymore.
I don't
think they do either.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. So you ended up moving on from Bloomberg, as did I. I can't remember who left first. Probably me.
Probably you.
I think for me, actually, I worked for a whole nother year. Bloomberg was the best job I ever had.
Me too.
Loved it. I really regret that I ever left, to be honest. I mean, not ever, but at the time, I regret that I left. I met somebody. I decided to get married. He did not want me to work anymore. But before that, like a year after September 11th, it was the anniversary. And it was the first time in all the years, right? Because now we've done this 24 times. But it was where everybody was remembering a year later. And it was just the way, you know, it was being covered and the way it was being covered and all that was great. For me, it was having to relive it. And it was very difficult for me
And for me, it was hard. And,
yeah.
And your level of exposure was emotionally was 1,000 times mine. And mine was unbearable, honestly.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't blame you.
And so I had to take a leave of absence again a year later. And then I kind of got it together, worked there, but then eventually ended up leaving, getting married. That was a whole nother mistake. But I ventured off to Vegas and started working in Vegas, which I also loved. Totally different life. But for you, you moved on to NBC. Can you talk a little bit about that? How different was it from Bloomberg?
The difference is incredible. I mean, it was just because Bloomberg was a relatively small television station, so much less celebrity, much less sort of notoriety.
And you were the big celebrity.
And I was Mr. Big over there for a minute. And so, but the culture, but the people were incredibly hardworking, incredibly intelligent, incredible people, basically. NBC had this beautiful front end and certainly was great for my career in terms of elevating my public profile and opportunity, but the culture was much more. Here's what I learned in that transition, to say this in the most elegant way. Okay. When you're inside of a growing, there's two ways to relate to the world. One is what I'll say is an offensive posture, where if somebody that works with you has a great idea, your inclination is to say, tell me about your idea. How do I help you? Let's do it. And then there's another world where somebody has an idea and every other person and every other idea is a threat. So you can either have a defensive psychological position where anything that Rachel gets comes at my expense or anything that I get comes at your expense is one psychological profile. And the other psychological profile is that we can always make the pie bigger. And the more Rachel or the more I can get out of you, the more I can make maximum Rachel, or the more people help make maximum me or maximum each other, that's good for all of us.
Yeah.
And Bloomberg to me was defined by the culture of we can always make the pie bigger. And your job is to work with the people around you to get the best out of them. You can be demanding early, late, all the intensity, but help them. Give them more resources. Make the introduction.
Be a teammate.
And make the introduction. Oh, you should know this person. Don't withhold information from them to try to make it more difficult. It's hard. Life is hard enough.
Right.
Whereas NBC was really dominated by, as an incumbent, that was in slow decay, even though it's a massive business. You can see it's still in decay.
Yeah.
But not just NBC, all those old media companies.
Sure.
And so everybody's making a lot of money and all the things. And the culture is one that is, anything for you comes at my expense.
Right.
So it was a big transition.
Meaning they saw that only a few people could be at the top.
And it's in my interest for you to fail.
Right. Got it.
As opposed to, is it in my interest? The simplest way to say it is, at Bloomberg, it's in my interest for you to succeed. At NBC, the culture was, it's in my interest for you to fail.
Right. So you started there.
2003. I with my own television show.
Okay.
Which was,
So that was a big step up. That was a big deal.
Yeah, for me, I would say yes.
Okay.
So I started.
Was that one Fast Money?
No, that was called Bullseye.
Oh, right.
It was short-lived.
Bullseye with Dylan Ratigan.
Bullseye with Dylan Ratigan. It was one of my least successful undertakings.
What
but
was
I think
the premise of that?
That it was lacking a premise,
got
which
it
was part of the issue.
Okay.
You see.
Okay.
And so the absence of a premise made it a very a less successful product.
It didn't stand out. Okay.
And then that show was canceled. And then the way television works, they can take you off the air, but you have these contracts. So then you end up just being very well paid to do nothing, which is very degrading ultimately.
Right.
And then so there was another person there who was another executive, a television, big television producer, named Jonathan Wald, who had been in charge of the Today Show, who had also been deactivated. Mm-hmm. And so we were both just sitting in the office. And I think Katrina happened, or the flood, something happened, some big news item happened, and they needed to launch. They wanted to fire me for sure.
Okay.
Like they were like waiting to fire me, right? And they probably wanted to fire him.
Right.
They're just like one more year with these guys, and they're out.
And you were just behind the scenes at this point.
I was just collecting
hanging out.
Money.
Yeah. Okay.
Hanging out.
But still coming into the office.
You have to.
Bothering people.
Well, not even just.
Just hanging out.
Hanging around. I don't try to bother people.
Well, okay.
I mean, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder.
Right. That's right.
So we Jonathan and I did a show, and that show became very successful. It was called On the Money. I won't say very successful. It was successful.
Okay.
And then we started a segment on that show called Fast Money.
And the premise was...
That was a show that I'd always been pitching to Michael Bloomberg, which is, Mike, this is stupid to have everybody on these sets. We're reading these scripts with stock prices, all these things. It's not interesting.
Yeah.
Don't you think it'd be more interesting just to sit around with no script and talk to people who are actually doing it every day and be like, Rachel, why did you do this? Why did you do that? And Mike liked the idea. We liked each other, but the structure of Bloomberg Television was not one that was going to have a big whatever.
Yeah.
So we started that as a segment on the show.
Okay.
And the segment was highly rated. They had just launched Mad Money, which has been on forever. And so the producers of Mad Money wanted another show. We went to the owners of the NASDAQ in Times Square. They were like, we'll give you your own studio in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then that became one of the most successful television shows in the history of financial television.
Amazing.
Life is one part planning, one part accident. So right. You just got to keep going.
So how did that end? How did that come to...
Fast Money?
Mm-hmm.
How did that end?
This was before...
This was before the financial crisis. Fast Money became a sensation. It was like crowds in Times Square. And so it was like a TV. It was the first time I was actually lived as some version of a very relatively small, but still as a TV star. Crowds, security, billboards, things, right. TV things.
So now you're really well known.
Really well is a strong word. I'm known
within
a small group.
Okay. So let's fast forward then to 2011, is it?
Well, 2009 is the financial crisis, and I become very aggressive and critical of the solution to the financial crisis.
Right.
Up to the point where I decline an offer from CNBC offered me a 5-year contract to stay after that, which I declined in a fairly contentious interaction.
Okay.
Although it was fine. And then I transitioned from CNBC to MSNBC on the thinking that I felt that what happened in 2009 was evidence of political corruption in the United States of America, because effectively what I perceived happened in the financial crisis was the largest theft and cover up in the history of the world, where basically a small group of individuals on the board of directors and the CEOs of the large banks compensated themselves for 10 years for a bunch of risk that was taken that they actually couldn't manage. I can pay myself for risk as long as I don't have to pay that. If I bet in Vegas every time and I only collect the winners and I don't have to pay the losers, my only incentive is to bet as much as humanly possible.
Right.
And that was what was going on Wall Street. And I was very vocal in being critical of that, up to the point where I resigned and gave up a lot of resources and security and took up a much more insecure job as a political host at MSNBC, which then became a couple more years of political confrontation with the American government in a very direct manner because of the profile of that job and a lot of time in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I wrote a book that was a New York Times bestseller, more criticism, 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 culminating in 2011.
Well, criticism, but...
Criticism being you are This is a corrupt system. Both political parties are working in conjunction mm-hmm. to extract huge amounts of resources from the American people yeah. on behalf of a very small group of individuals,
right.
which is something that I still believe is true. Mm-hmm. And I was very precise. I spent 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, outlining precisely how I believe that was happening. I wrote a book, as I mentioned, yeah. outlining precisely how I believe that was happening. And I would spend time in private meetings with U.S. senators, U.S. cabinet secretaries, the U.S. presidents, U.S. congresspeople, and explaining to them what you're doing is enabling a system. And that system is a pay-to-play system based on gerrymandered political districts. So you actually don't even have the ability to actually select your representation because it's pre-selected by the way that because the political parties select their own voters. Mm-hmm. So this part of Florida is Republican. This part of New York is Democrat. And it's the cake is baked. It's a pretend game.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I was explaining all the layers of that, which I'm happy to do that again with you now.
Well, so no, I just want to, for people that are listening, sure. if they're like, I'm getting confused by this. I sure. just want to say the point is no longer were you a guy who was a talking head, who was a person who was up there
who's just
being paid to talk about business news, financial news, political news. You were invested now. You had been writing a book where you were spending all this time doing research and really knowing the subject, the answers, the questions, the whys, and the how to fix it.
I was effectively a political activist at this point as a cable news host and author.
Right. So here we
triggered by the financial crisis.
Right. So here we get to this day that if people Google Dylan Ratigan, there is what people call a rant, I guess.
I believe that's what they call it.
A rant. Where do you want to describe it? You're hosting a roundtable with three people. Mm-hmm. And we don't really get to see what happens up until that moment. Mm-hmm. I guess we could watch that. But this poor guy who had really was caught in the crosshairs and had nothing to say in this 4 minutes, and these two girls that were fighting to talk, and it was essentially about the debt ceiling.
And it was about the government in general. I mean, yeah. I'll try to give you the most efficient description.
Okay.
I began the process of my political activism mm-hmm. as an advocate for the American people, as I see it, mm-hmm. against the coordinated corruption of the two political parties working together. In 2009. So then for my perception was, okay, I've spent all of 2009 talking about this, doing thousands of hours of detailed segments and guests and people and things, and then the book and the speeches and on and on. All of 2009, all of 2010, all of 2011. So that's 3 years of my life. And now it's the summer of 2011, and it's the same, what I perceive to be, stupid conversation.
Yeah.
And I also was in the middle of, I was spending my mornings at that time writing the book in my apartment. Mm-hmm. And so I was really deep in the gory details of the corruption because I was just studying, the money goes here and the money goes there, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was particularly sensitive to it. And I also probably didn't have a lot of sleep because I was writing a book at the same time that I'm hosting this TV show every day and whatever. And so then I came to work and, I believe I just became very frustrated. It was accumulated frustration from 3 years of effort on my part. But it was also, I have a different perspective on it now, which I can and share in a minute. But the context of it at that time was, I've been working on this for 3 years. This is stupid.
Right.
This entire conversation is stupid. And I basically became more emotionally animated.
Yeah.
And articulated that frustration. Now, retrospectively, I believe that one of my lessons now is that it is a mistake to assume responsibility for the world outside of yourself. The mistake that when you become a political advocate, mm-hmm. your ego gets too big. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, oh, well, my opinion really matters and I have the power. I'm going to change the government. I'm going to get the Senate to do this. I'm going to get the government. I've got these lists, hundreds of thousands of people are with me, of all these support, sort of all this validation, which misleads you or misled me into this, what I think, very ego-driven mindset. Mm-hmm. And then
meaning that you felt you could
like
change it.
Yeah, like I thought I'll change the legislation.
Well, she kept saying how, why, and you had the answers.
Yeah,
you knew
I do
it.
Have the, I do, and I still have the answer. Right. I don't have it. I believe I have answers that are worthy of discussion.
Right.
At the time, my ego would have said, I have the answers, do what I say.
Right.
I wouldn't present it that way at this point in my life. And so, yes, it became accumulated frustration and attracted the attention of many millions of human beings.
But ultimately...
And I think resonated because I think a lot of people agree with me. And I think a lot of people are frustrated.
And that's what I was going to say. Ultimately, it made a lot of noise. And, you know, you can see you went on this rant and it became a thing that went viral. But everyone said, Dylan Ratigan loses it on air, but rightly so.
That's right.
And if you look it up today... You almost think this could have happened yesterday.
That's how you know the system is so messed up.
Right.
Is literally that if you look at that comment, that clip from me from 2011, it's 2025. It's going to be 2026.
Right.
It's 15 years ago. It's not yesterday.
Right.
Exact same thing. I also believe that's very much why you have the Trump phenomenon. I think that the Trump phenomenon and the Bernie phenomenon, both the Trump and the Bernie aspects, or Mamdani and now, like, okay. All the political extremism, both on the left and right, I think is very much derived from the correct perception of the corruption of the traditional Republican and Democratic parties. I actually just think that whether it's the left, that the Trump or the Bernie solution are the incorrect, they are identifying the correct problem in my view, but they're not offering the correct solutions. Which is on different conversation.
Right. But just like briefly to people that are listening and want to know your answer on this, what do you see as the solution, or where are we at right now that people should be thinking, oh, this is what the future looks like. This is how things are going to change now that Trump is in office.
Yeah, I mean, so power is like water. And water flows based on the force of gravity and the structure underneath it. So think of a riverbed. And the riverbed dictates the flow of the river based on if the riverbed is steep, the water goes really fast. If the riverbed is shallow, flat, then the river goes very slow. Mm-hmm. If the riverbed has a big tree in it, then the river goes around the tree, whatever it is. What we see in our politics is all this discussion about, think of the water as all the resources, it's all the money of all the people, all the not just America, but the whole world.
Yeah.
See it in Italy too, by the way. That the water... That the politicians, whether it's Trump or the left or the right, it doesn't matter, spend their time talking about what the water should do. We should give the money to these people. We should give the money to those people. We need to spend more on defense. We need to do this. As opposed to dealing with the underlying structure of the river bed. And so, and I'm not trying to give you a deliberately opaque or complex metaphor. This goes one of two ways. Power is either widely distributed and resources are either a lot of people have a little bit of money or a lot of people have some money and a lot of people have some power,
right,
or a few people have a lot of money and a lot of power and everybody else has nothing. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that exists. And so the thing that's appealing about the traditional Republican Party or the traditional conservative mindset, rhetorically, it's not true in practice, which is a point of great frustration, which is why I ended up yelling on television, is they advocate for distributed power, states' rights, stay out of my bedrooms, go to you do you, no taxes, you keep your money, figure it out, whatever. But what we're seeing with the Republicans, and we've seen it for decades, and we're seeing it with this administration, is they're just as interested in consolidating power for themselves and accumulating resources for themselves as the left is. And so the real question, so you say, what's the solution? The solution is a set of tax policies, interest rate policies, basically financing policies, bank regulation policies that force more smaller banks, fewer large banks, and more money to be distributed to more places in the private sector, right? And so the more that there was a Jewish Supreme Court justice named Louis Brandeis. People may have heard of Brandeis University, and I think it's in Boston or some such thing. And he was very famous, and I think he's worth Googling or use ChatGPT and say, who's Louis Brandeis? And he was his line was, the further a person is from a problem, the less qualified they are to make the decision. So you always want to create systems where the problem solving and the decision making is made as close as possible to the problem.
Right.
And when you move power away from Milwaukee or Wyoming or upstate New York or South Florida or Eureka, California, or I could name 1,000 places. And when you take power away from those places and move it all to Washington, D.C., it makes everything worse. The problem is that both political parties, but particularly the Republican Party, uses the rhetoric of saying, we're not going to do that. And then when the Republican Party comes in, they come in and they've got the biggest budget ever. They've got the biggest deficits ever. They're actually accumulating more resources than anybody.
Right.
And that is frustrating.
Right. Right.
I hope that was not boring.
No, not boring at all. And I have a million other questions
but
about that.
But my point is, you want to deal with the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't want to tell you what to do.
No, I
want to give you an environment where you're naturally going to do things that are going to be healthy for you and for the society.
Right. Right. And ultimately,
Bloomberg didn't tell you what to do. No. Bloomberg created an office culture where you were naturally rewarded for doing things that were valuable for the company. So if you were hostile to your colleagues and didn't make introductions and didn't help people out, you were not going to advance.
Right, right.
Whereas NBC had a culture where if you were hostile to your colleagues and nasty, you could advance.
Yeah, right. This could be a whole other podcast, so I'll stop it here. But it is fascinating, and it is, I think that people are really starting to see that a lot of change that they were hoping for and why they get involved in their local politics or whatever's going on, that is going nowhere. And it's frustrating. And I've had a couple of people on the show to talk about that here in Florida and in different places.
But it's everywhere.
And then I've had, right. And then I've had the bigger politicians on the show that still complain about the same thing. So it's kind of,
it's a universal, it is a universal thing, which, so I say my final conclusion is the more that my decision, as I remove myself from it, obviously long ago, the more you can focus on how you treat other people in your life, instead of it's to sit and complain about how other people treat people is very rewarding emotionally, but it's a very low vibrational action as opposed to making the decision. And we all do it. You're all like, oh, Trump this or Biden that, or this, whatever. It doesn't matter that you're like, look at this guy. It's like a pleasure. You look around the telly, you're like, well, I got to see it.
Yeah,
and so, or the more you can recognize in yourself when you're doing that and sort of moving into that sort of stimulation of that low vibration and move to a higher vibration, which is I'm going to reduce my attention on things that are outside of my control, and I'm going to treat myself better first and foremost.
Right.
I'm going to drink water. I'm going to sleep. I'm going to exercise. I'm not going to smoke, whatever it is. I'm going to treat myself better physically and emotionally.
Yeah.
And I'm going to treat the people in my life better. More patience, more empathy, more engagement. Even I'm going to treat the strangers, you know, I'm going to hold the door. I mean, I know these sounds like stupid things, but the more that we are kinder to ourselves and those around us in the tiniest way is vastly more valuable from a vibrational standpoint than sitting back and
just complaining.
Complaining.
You ran, you got involved in politics.
And that was the conclusion of my political activism. Started in 2009, and then I ran for Congress in 2018.
Okay. And do you ever think you'll do it again?
I will not.
But you had so much to say, and you were so good.
I know. But the political, I shouldn't say I know. Thank you. the system is incentives. The political system is designed to reward the people that are really good at raising money and really good at character assassination rise to the top.
Right. And you are not.
And I'm not a great character assassin.
Right. Well, because I don't think you believe that that's where the problem is. You focus on the problem.
Right.
Yeah. You focus on
it's much easier to get ahead through assassination than. And so what you really have in our government is some of the most skilled fundraisers and character assassins in the world because the system has filtered for that skill set.
Right, right. Okay, so you're not going to do that anymore.
No.
You now live in Italy.
Yes, I do.
You are involved in... Well, first of all, before you get into that, weren't you involved in, like, a plant company? Lettuce? What did you do with that? What was that? You're building...
I did lettuce.
Okay.
I did lettuce.
How'd that go for you?
Not very well.
Okay.
Not very well.
Why? What was it? Tell people what it was.
So this is when you know your ego has gone out of, this is why like things have gone crazy.
Okay.
So I'm in the political activism routine and I've decided that basically I'm a huge advocate for distributed resources, Judge Louis Brandeis, more resources in more places. Okay. Also a huge advocate of technology. the obvious technologies that we all use in, on the sort of computer side, but agricultural technology, transportation technology. I'm a believer in technology and a believer in distributed resources. And so I get it in my mind that we can basically create a kit that you could put anywhere in the world, okay, and you deploy the kit, and the kit will immediately provide electricity via solar power, immediately use the solar power to clean water, use the solar power to facilitate, to operate a pop-up hydroponic farm. So basically you could take a 40-foot shipping container, pack it, like a picture like an IKEA kit, a box, but the IKEA box is loaded with enough gear that when you that you could drop it out of the back of a C-17 or some big airplane with a couple of parachutes, drop it down, have it land, unpack it, stand up a hydroponic farm, stand up a solar power station, establish Wi-Fi, establish electricity, run a water filter, and run an operating farm.
It's not a bad idea.
It's an incredibly great idea.
So what happened?
Oh, it was amazing. And everybody loved it.
Right.
Right. Not only was it a good idea, but I took a bunch of my own money and enrolled other people to put their money and hired a team of oil field services engineers in Lafayette, Louisiana, because who can do something like this?
Right.
So I'm like, who's going to build this thing? I'm like, we're going to Louisiana, the oil guys, because in New York, you can't do anything because everybody's, oh, we'll do a TV show. We'll do, you know, right, they don't do anything.
Right.
Or maybe they'll do a, they're a banker. They're like, we'll give you a loan. Okay, great. No, no, I need to make a thing. Mm-hmm. No one makes a thing in New York. No one makes a thing in California. No one really probably makes a thing in Florida. But they make things in Texas and in Louisiana. Like, they make things. Mm-hmm. Oil rigs. So I'm like, we're going to Louisiana. So go to Louisiana. We make this whole thing. It's amazing. The thing's amazing. And the problem when you have a really amazing thing and you have lots of, like, love friends who like you and they have lots of power and whatever, they love your idea.
Right.
So you're getting all this encouragement. Just like you're like, that's a great idea. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to do a network of these outposts. I call them outposts. Mm-hmm. And we'll pop them off, ping, 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 whether it's the food deserts in Brooklyn or whether it's the refugee camps in Turkey or everything in between. From Iraq to Brooklyn.
Okay, so all this sounds great. So what happened?
Amazing. Such great meetings. State Department, USAID,
what happened?
Gates Foundation, CZI to the Zuckerberg. So you want to hear very cynical? I'm sorry.
I want to hear what happened.
What became apparent, mm-hmm, whether it's the U.S. State Department, where I had very senior meetings, uh-huh, or whether it was with the government of the in Abu Dhabi, uh-huh, or you know, in order to get to Iraq, you have to go through Vienna. Back in the, it was a, quite a thing. Anyway, you could go to Erbil. Okay. Anyway, it's not worth it. Okay. But what becomes apparent is that those who have the resources, whether it's the large charitable foundations, Gates Foundation, et cetera, yeah, or the governments, their relationship with helping people is to manufacture dependency.
Okay.
So the problem with my proposal is it created independence.
Okay.
So they would say, we don't want to give them a working farm with power and all that thing. We want to give them bottles of water and
so
bags of
dependent rice
so that that way we can control them. Like, if we give them your device, we lose power over them.
Right.
But if we constantly supply them with rice and beans and water, then we have the ability to choke the resources back to control them.
Right. Got it.
So then I tried to make it into a commercial business. Anyway, it was very challenging to make that into a business that makes money, but it was a phenomenal education for me, not just in terms of the cynicism of politics, but just on the enterprise. It was my first major enterprise
as
a business.
Is the book closed on that, or were you just ahead of your time? And
maybe as a result of this extremely popular, high-profile podcast,
right,
we will receive some magic inbound that somebody's going to say, we're going to do that. We're going to rename it. The maybe I've been misunderstood.
Right.
I was misunderstood, by the way.
I know you were. That's why you're here.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. And the one of the many misunderstandings, I was misunderstood regarding my intentions with this farming thing, because we were like, oh, you're growing weed or you're growing lettuce. Or, no. I'm like, no. We are trying to offer distributed resources, power, water, Wi-Fi, and food in a way that can be popped up literally around the world in a way that will seed a level of stability and opportunity that likes of which the world has never seen.
Right.
And I believe that is very much still true, and I am ahead of my time, and maybe the time will come.
Okay, I love it.
And I'm sure the oil engineers in Lafayette will be ready to start banging them out anytime.
Okay. So let's get into what you do now, because you are a Renaissance man. You have, we were talking about this on the way over here, you have the ability to take your skills, and you are good at just about anything. You could start anything, and what ends up getting in the way sometimes is you. Sometimes you're ahead of your time. Sometimes, do you know what I mean? Like, you have these big ideas and people...
No, of course. I'm smirking at your accuracy, not at you.
People have not caught up to it yet. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means...
They call it product market fit.
Okay. So now here you are, living in Milan.
I'm Milanese.
Speaking the language. And wearing the shoes.
I am wearing Italian shoes.
So why a shoe... What are you doing in a shoe company?
Well, first of all, can we talk about... The name of the shoe company is Euphoria.
Okay.
With the Italian spelling.
Yeah.
Euphoria.
Did you come up with the name?
I did.
Okay.
I did come up with the name.
Why?
Because I received a request. For a private collection of Italian sneakers, and in order for me to provide the private collection of Italian sneakers, I needed to have a company.
Got it.
And so I was like, if we're going to take this contract and sell these people sneakers, they need a company to buy them from.
So this was going to be like a one-time thing.
It was a one-time thing. Okay. A friend of mine who was from the technology world in California was doing a private party for a bunch of tech founders. They were doing an anniversary for an IPO for one of the companies, and they had an idea of doing a party favor of these shoes that were covered in artwork, original artwork.
Right.
There's a yellow one up there. Mm-hmm. And it was done as a private collection. It'd be like you're in Palm Beach. Palm Beach, they do big parties.
And imagine, one was different.
Each one was a different one.
Okay.
And it was done as a private collection for a group of technology founders in California.
So here you are now.
Well, no. So then that collection, so I found a factory that does handmade production in Venice, Italy, mm-hmm. what's called a vulcanized sole, which is a fancy sole. With a nice sort of Nike style, like it has a memory, like the inside of the thing is ridiculously, I mean, here's my shoe ad. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the inside of the shoe, it's like a really nice shoe. This first collection was a huge hit, just privately.
And people were like, where can I get
my I love this, what is this company? This is not Golden Goose, this is not Zegna, this is not whatever. Obviously, it's not any of those things, but like it's this Italian handmade luxury sneaker company. What is this? Mm-hmm. Who knows? It's nothing. It's me with my friends in Italy.
Right.
We'd have a website. We'd have anything. Then we got another request for that shoe behind you with the kiss from a company called Sugarfina.
I know it well.
And so Sugarfina said, we want to do a private collection for us. You did a private collection for the tech founders up in Palo Alto. Let's do a private collection for Sugarfina using our Sugar Lips candy for our stores in Beverly Hills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So these private collections started coming in.
Okay.
This is a couple years ago. And then in the process, I was introduced to a group of young Italians who are sneaker professionals mm-hmm. working for big Italian shoe brands, Dior, Jimmy Choo, Premiata, Versace, whatever. These brands people know. I'm obviously not a sneaker person, mm-hmm. but especially now that I'm a little bit more experienced, or I would even say a lot more experienced, I'm very, very quick to understand when I don't know something, to get help mm-hmm. immediately. And so I reached out to them and I said, we have this opportunity, we have these resources, we have this momentum in the private market. Would you like to join with me to create a new Italian sneaker company? And they, you know, had some contingencies, of course. They're like, yeah, I'll do it if you do, you know, and there's certain things that are certain under certain requirements, yes, we will. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up with, you know, there's probably 12 of them all in, you know, a couple full-time, one for sure full-time, and then 10 or 12 of them part-time, but a lot of part-time work from them. And they expanded beyond these art sneakers, which are exciting to look at, to what, like this one in front of you, which is made of Italian, handmade of Italian goat leather with the memory foam insole, mm-hmm. that is what I would argue will be the softest and most comfortable shoe that you will ever sneaker that you'll ever wear. So, but the point is, we went from doing sort of these wild and crazy things right. to what would be more, you know, this we have. There's a suede. This one here. There's a pink. This pink suede one
soft
is super
pink, hot. Pink.
Super yeah. popular.
For men and women.
For men and women. I only brought the women's because yeah. you are a fabulous lady.
Right.
But there are, there is a men's version thereof.
Right.
We took it to Paris a couple months ago. It was extremely well received there. We got a distribution deal in Japan. So now we're going to go to Japan.
But what's the goal? Like, are you trying to get on Shark Tank? Are you trying to
go public? The goal is to provide the world with the most comfortable and stylish Italian sneaker ever.
And be a household name because that's 100%. The only thing that people want to wear.
And it's the fastest growing category in the world
yeah.
because of COVID and the transition away from Bali, away from churches, away from Brooks Brothers to these luxury sneakers.
And also, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say the price point is high because it's
600.
Luxury, but it's not as high as a Xenia.
Exactly.
Right.
It's sort of, I call it, Zoe, who's our head of sales, doesn't love when I say this, but I so she'll but it's sort of, I call it Brunello Cucinelli on the outside and Nike on the inside.
Got it.
And it basically is a $400 to $600 Italian handmade luxury sneaker that's extremely well made and extremely stylish that you can wear every day, where you might not wear your Xenia or your Cucinelli shoes all the time every day because they are so expensive.
Right. Talk to me for a second about customer service, because I also know that you yep. now own reservations.com yep. and customer service in something like this has got to be a big deal.
Critical.
If someone in America is trying to buy shoes online,
yep.
how do we know our fit?
There's a stat. So the fit is something that's always imperfect.
Yep.
Right. And so if you really want to know your fit, what you have to do is measure your, how many inches is your foot?
Got it.
Which I don't want to do that.
No, but they have these little things you go into the shoe
and then
store.
And then you convert to your European or your American size. Okay. But because of the partnership with TTM, which is a huge agency based in Milan that is one of the best customer services agencies in the world mm-hmm. and that is one of the best logistics agencies in the world, Euphoria's customer service is powered by the TTM relationship, and TTM is an extraordinarily successful business that specializes in logistics and customer service, meaning that we have a warehouse and the exchanges and the response rate, all the things that you would expect from an established Italian luxury brand exist at Euphoria because of the TTM agency relationship.
Okay, so people in America should not hesitate to be buying these.
At all.
Okay.
No, sure.
And what are, when we look online, how many different collections do you have?
There's 30 men's and 30 women's. Everything right now is working only on this one style.
Got it.
But with different, some with suede, some with goat leather.
Are you going to do a high top?
Eventually, lots of things will get done.
Got it.
But for the moment, we just want to sort of establish ourselves. My priority is to establish a high level of brand awareness so that when you see this version of this type of a shoe, you know it's a Euphoria shoe.
Right.
We talked about doing, you can do a high top. You can do a runner, basically. There's lots of things that can be done.
Sure.
But I think that creates brand confusion at the outset. Yeah. So I thought that to sort of hold with this specific thing. And because the shoe, when you wear it, is so comfortable, and I believe patience are to our advantage right now, as the first few hundred and few thousand customers are putting on the shoes at right now, I believe that word of mouth is going to be a very powerful marketing tool for the company.
It's also a really good time after COVID. Less and less people are going back into the office. People are working from home. People are more casual. You don't see women in heels all the time.
Exactly.
So it is more normal to see sneakers. And even kids, you know, when they get dressed up, girls in dresses are yeah. wearing sneakers. So exactly. Teenagers, I was saying when I was looking at this, my daughter and all of her friends, this is what they would be wearing.
Exactly.
Right now they're wearing the Adidas, right. whatever it is.
Exactly.
And this is comparable, but looks obviously elevated right. and nicer. So talk to me about reservations.com too, really briefly.
No, I mean, reservations.com was really just opportunistic. All of these things are ultimately opportunistic, but I bought reservations.com because of a longstanding friendship and partnership and relationship with a man named Tim Henschel and his partner, John Prince, who actually are also down here in Florida. They are the founders of a company called Lexel Travel Technologies, which is one of the most important travel tech companies in the world right now. And so Lexel Travel Tech powers another company called Hotel Planner. And so when I found out that Reservations was for sale, I found out I had the opportunity to buy it. And I found out I had the opportunity to use the Lexel Travel Technologies back end, their inventory and their customer service, their AI, to power it. It was really an opportunity. And I did think reservations is a great domain. I'm a very hospitable guy. Mm-hmm. I like to host people. I like to be out with people.
Right.
And so I thought it would be fun to have basically a hospitality business.
Right.
Using what I think is one of the most a domain name that has some of the highest potential in the world, because even though reservations.com right now is selling a few thousand hotel rooms a day, there's no reason reservations.com can't sell tickets and can't have a broader mandate.
100%. Okay, so there's a huge upside there by owning the domain, and you're involved. Like, you're not just buying it.
I'm completely involved,
okay.
And I am incredibly enthusiastic and appreciative of that business.
Amazing.
And I need to travel a lot for the sneakers.
Right.
So I'm a good brand ambassador for reservations.com.
Right.
Because how can I be in South Florida with you if I didn't make a reservation?
That's right.
That's my...
I love it. All right. So we could talk all day, but I know that we need to stop. So
okay.
I do want to thank you for coming on. I do think you are someone who has been misunderstood, but in a way that so many people listen. Do you know what I mean? There are mm-hmm. people that are misunderstood and people dismiss them. They think it's all sorts of things. For you, I truly believe that you're too smart for your own good sometimes. Mm. You're ahead of the curve. You're ahead of and it becomes threatening to people. Mm. And but it's not being misunderstood. It's more that you have such a powerful voice. And anytime you walk into a room, everybody is aware of it. And so
not necessarily with a positive point of view.
Well, but I'm saying sometimes that triggers other people to react in a way that makes them misunderstand you.
Yeah.
So, you know,
thank you.
We could also talk about how something that makes you so good at work can make you so terrible in relationships.
We could talk.
We could talk about that in a whole podcast.
Are you suggesting that I'm terrible in relationships?
No,
well, you
but I
just
we,
think you
no,
did.
No, we
think
know you, that you've had a history though of being just like me.
What of being what?
Of being. Highly not emotional. That's a terrible word.
That's not true.
Highly.
What do we know?
Well, I don't want to say people's names, but I remember. Listen, I can also say highly romantic.
I am romantic.
Into work for a 5 a.m. shift. I was telling my fiance, leave at the end of the day, fly to London for a girl who you thought you were in love with, cook her dinner, fly right back so you could be back in studio 5 a.m.
Well, I said to this particular individual, can you have dinner tomorrow? And she said, I'm in London. And I said, I didn't ask you where you're located. I said, are you free for dinner tomorrow?
Hot. Love it. And we all lived vicariously through you because we wanted to
hear. And I flew over there and I cooked her dinner.
Yeah.
Her and her sister.
Right. So I think you have these great big ideas. And I think they're amazing. And sometimes
it's a different podcast.
Yeah, it's a different podcast. Because sometimes you may get excited about something. Not you, just you, but people.
Sure.
Get excited about something before they should get excited about it.
I think that
And
that's
you were gone plenty of weekends because you were cooking dinner.
I know. But I was also, I would say at this point, I'm a little bit more. I've taken, you know, you take some licks along the way. So
right.
you learn, so you know, the life sort of corrects you.
Right.
And so I appreciate that version of myself because
yeah,
it was so
sure.
much enthusiasm and all the rest of that was very, very, very romantic.
Never lose.
I'm very romantic.
Yeah.
Can I make one comment very quickly?
100%. You can say
I'm just really a pleasure for me to be here. And just want to say that I know that you have also have been misunderstood. And I feel like I've always had a very clear understanding of you and at your best. And I was introduced to the best version of you when you were right after you graduated from university. And I've been able to watch you both at your at wonderful highs in your life. And I know some challenging moments in your life. And I just am incredibly proud of the person that you are and the person that you've always been and the way that you have taken the good parts of your life and also the challenges in your life and made them all a foundation for your life today in a way that's incredibly impressive, incredibly difficult to do. both your talent in doing this, but also your emotional strength and spiritual strength. I would say that when life is challenging, the only way to navigate it is with a spiritual solution. And I believe that those of us that have significant challenges or unexpected negative events are being called to a higher spiritual life, and it's a blessing. And I think that you are blessed in that way, and I'm really proud of what you are, who you are, and I'm happy to be your friend. So thank you.
Oh, Dylan, I love you so much.
Me
thank
too.
You.
All right.
Thank you. Anyone who wants to find you, reach you, know more about the shoes, where can they locate you?
The sneaker website is Euphoria Sneakers, EUFORIA. You can practice your Italian. Want to try it with me? Euphoria.
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 How'd I do?
Very good.
Euphoria.
No, Euphoria.
Euphoria.
I don't even really know myself.
Okay. Close enough.
And then the Instagram is euphoria.sneakers, and my Instagram is dylan.ratigan, R-A-T-I-G-A-N.
Great. Dylan, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor, and I am so lucky to know you.
The feeling is mutual.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.